Good evening. It's good to see each one of you, and lovely to be here at Camrose United Church. Thank you so much. This evening we have the pleasure of listening to and engaging Dwight Friesen in conversation. Dwight grew up in Africa, the Ivory Coast, Malawi. His parents were missionaries there for many, many years. And then he returned to Canada, studied initially at Briarcrest, not far from Regina. Some of you may know Briarcrest. Got interested in a whole range of questions about representation. Over dinner, he was talking a little bit about how he was musing on one occasion some years ago on what it would have meant to an elder of in an African village to see a film of Jesus playing on the wall of a hut. And what would they actually see, and what would they make of this? In any case, those questions of representation and the meaning of image have preoccupied him, and so much so that he went to Edinburgh, which has a doctoral program on theology and film, and actually defended and was duly doctored this summer. So it's lovely that you've come, and we're looking forward to this. His dissertation, as well as his talk tonight, look at a film, well, he will give you the details, of course, but made by of Jesus, on the subject of Jesus, by a couple of Hindu filmmakers. So it's I'm really looking forward to it. So thank you. Please. Thank Dr. Friesen.
Thank you. Is that okay? Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. This is probably the first time that I've had the chance to begin to unpack these thoughts without deep concerns about what somebody else thinks of them. So it's nice to be able to just sort of begin to reflect a little bit. I want to thank Dr. Goa, trustees, I imagine, of the Ronning Center. I don't know who all's involved. Alan Richards for hosting this evening. Rebecca for making sure that I had my act together before I came up here. And probably a number of people that I'm not aware of who are instrumental in making this opportunity possible. And I understand this is being recorded, so I just want to say thank you to those of you who may have had a part in it and I haven't met you. I consider it an honor to be able to re-engage some of the material and thoughts that I've spent so much time with, and trust that my revisiting of it will be helpful for you in thinking about how you watch film and why. The format this evening is going to be a mixture of me reading some of a paper and then occasionally stopping to show you a couple of clips. I've tried to prepare something that's meaningful. I hope that it's not distracting, this sort of flipping back and forth between the various media. But we'll give it our best shot. And if you have any questions, of course, please save them to the end. Right. Discussions about the title, Do You See What I See? Film, Religion, and Theology in the History of East Indian. And I found, after coming back to Canada, that I had to qualify that, because in the UK it was just Indian, of an East Indian Jesus movie. Discussions about the religious or theological significance of movies have gained considerable momentum over the last two decades. Once dominated by Western Christian scholars, The conversation now represents contributors from a variety of academic disciplines, faith traditions, and cinematic cultures. Such methodological diversity has spawned more complex accounts of film's relationship to religion and theology than strictly textual approaches, that is, examining films only, have to offer, and has challenged a general bias in the early literature toward analyses of Hollywood and European cinema. Recent attention to non-Western cinematic contexts in particular has contributed to the destabilization of a Western bias in the conversation and challenged some of the assumptions that shaped formative contributions to the topic. My thesis this evening, and my daughter warned me to read this sentence slowly, is that by virtue of its sufficiently familiar content, and yet what I suspect will be for most here tonight, the unfamiliar context in which it was produced and continues to be screened, the history of Karuna Maidu, which is Telugu for Man of Compassion, released in 1978, is an ideal case study with which to demonstrate how our understanding of film's relationship to religion and theology has been, or can be, complicated and enriched by paying attention to films from non-Western contexts. In other words, it invites us to consider the question posed by Noel Regney and Gloria Shane Baker's Christmas song that we may soon hear looping on all playlists. Do you see what I see? I begin with a brief synopsis of the film itself and then turn attention to the role of theological and religious traditions in the history and content of the film, and I will touch a little bit on its reception. But the difficult thing for me was trying to pick and choose what to talk about, because it's really a fascinating story that caught my attention, and it is rich with questions and themes for discussion. And I suspect that as you begin to get into the story of the movie, the questions are going to begin to surface in your mind, and I look forward to the question and answer time afterwards. So a brief synopsis. Karuna Maidu. Like most of the widely recognized Western movies of Jesus' life, Karuna Maidu, 1978, collates the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, played by Vijay Chandler. Woven into that harmonization are his encounters with... Am I in the way, by the way? Should I move? That's what this clip is for. Woven into that harmonization are his encounters with five other main characters. Barabbas, and Judas Iscariot, who appears in this story, Mary Magdalene, the disciple John, and his blind friend Malachi, are the five main characters in the story. Beginning with the angel's annunciation to Mary of Jesus' pending birth, the story includes many of the standard narratives common to the retelling of Jesus' life, including but not limited to his nativity, miracles, Sermon on the Mount, and triumphal entry into Jerusalem, the portrayal of his passion, resurrection, and ascension occupies the full second half of the movie. In one way or another, and at various stages in the story, each of the five characters mentioned above is won over by the compassion of Jesus. When we first meet them, Barabbas, Judas, and their band of zealots are waging guerrilla warfare against Rome and attempting to forge a strategic alliance with the increasingly popular itinerant preacher named Jesus. When Jesus declines the offer to join forces, Barabbas turns away in anger, but Judas opts to join Jesus' band of disciples, believing that some form of alliance may still be achieved. John, who also becomes one of Jesus' disciples, is a devout Jew in search of the Messiah. By contrast, John's blind friend Malachi laments the apparent absence of God in a corrupt and unjust world, and probably one of the more haunting scenes in the movie is his song of lament prior to the arrival of Jesus on the scene. Mary Magdalene, portrayed as a courtesan, finds her longing for love and significance fulfilled in Jesus' forgiveness of the woman caught in adultery. Following Jesus' resurrection, the story concludes with his final address to his disciples and the audience. to show compassion as he did, after which he ascends into a galaxy of stars. I'm deliberately not showing huge portions of the movie because at its shortest version, it's 2.5 hours. So we'd be here a little while, but I promise you I will be showing you some clips later. Taken at face value, Coming to My View is but another variation on the Jesus film genre. Given the context in which it was produced, however, I prefer to think of it as the biopic of a hybrid Jesus, a character that blends the protagonist of the Western Jesus film tradition with the godmen of India's religions and mythologies to inspire devotion to Jesus among the downtrodden of Indian society. Space and time do not allow for an in-depth textual analysis of the film. My objective tonight is to demonstrate from a sampling of the film's content, history, and reception how it invites us toward an enriched understanding of film's relationship to religion and theology. So to do that, I'm going to give you now a brief history of this movie because it's virtually unknown in Western scholarship. I've had the privilege of having one article published about the film, but I think apart from that, there are very few treatments of the movie in Western scholarship, and to my knowledge, very few in India as well, and I had the opportunity to confirm the number of fairly significant Indian cinema scholars who were surprised to find a white guy from Manitoba in South India, knocking about South India, asking questions about the film. Late in 1973, two Hindu filmmakers, hoping to secure funding for their Jesus film project from sympathetic representatives of the church, met with the directors of Amrutavani, a Roman Catholic communications agency in Secunderabad, India. Father Christopher Coilo, the Indian Franciscan priest who was eventually commissioned to write the film screenplay, was apprehensive about the proposal, since he had little faith in the artistic integrity of local filmmakers. His superiors, however, recognized an opportunity to fulfill the injunction of Vatican II in the Inter Mirifica to support worthwhile films, and therefore authorized a contribution of 200,000 rupees to the project, which at the time was around, at the time of writing, it was around $5,000, give or take a couple. Certainly not Gibson's budget. On the condition that Coilo would write the screenplay and function as co-director with final authority on all matters related to the film. Coilo's screenplay, initially titled Ralavu Kristu, apologies for pronunciation, which is Telugu for King of Kings, was completed late in the summer of 1974 with a production schedule of only a few months. Due to a number of unforeseen complications, however, 5 years passed before the film was finally released. The two filmmakers who had pitched the project funneled Amrutavani's investment into other initiatives, and the first few reels that they managed to produce failed to attract other investors. Unable to secure additional funding, they were eventually relieved of their duties, and initial prints of the film were returned over to Amrutavani. Had Vijay Chandra, the actor cast to play Jesus, not stepped forward to assume the additional role of producer, the project might well have been shelved. In a moment of inspiration that he would often regret, he told me, I actually found him and met him, stayed with him for a few days, Chandra made the bold and public decision to forego all future roles in the cinema industry until the film, retitled as Karuna Maidu to avoid legal complications, was completed. When asked what inspired an Orthodox Hindu to produce a movie about Jesus, he replied, "It's like this. A child falls into a well and cries for help. Suddenly one man jumps in and rescues the child. Everybody says, what a great thing he's done. But the man mutters to himself, who pushed me in? Like this man, I was also pushed in. Though in my case, it was not the people who pressed me, but some unseen, mysterious, supernatural force," which later he attributed to Jesus. Chandra's commitment would be severely tested. His peers in the industry warned that his career was doomed. At least one other South Indian film star had initiated a movie about Christ that was never completed. That was MGR. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with South Indian film, but he's a star in the history of South Indian cinema. Investors were hesitant to sign on because they assumed that the church would or should carry financial responsibility for the film. In an effort to drum up more funding, Chandra played the lottery, got involved in the garment business, and even mortgaged family property. A. Vimsing, the director Chandra had recruited to oversee the second chapter of the film's production history, was a veteran in the Telugu film industry whose reputation would have lent credibility to the project. Due to illness, however, he only contributed to the first 10 days of filming, and the baton was eventually passed to his brother-in-law, R. Tirumalai. Then, at the last hour, after investing nearly 3 million rupees and overcoming numerous obstacles to complete the film, Chandra's efforts nearly came to naught when the censorship board hesitated to approve it on account of its graphic portrayal of Jesus' crucifixion. That we're discussing the film today indicates that it would be great. But logistical challenges, obstacles were not Chandra's only challenge. The production was also plagued by interpersonal conflict. Not entirely surprising if you know anything about the film industry. Neither Chandra nor Tirumalai would have self-identified with the Christian tradition. And although both were sympathetic to Jesus, they occasionally found themselves at odds with Coelho's vision for the film. Whereas he wanted to produce an epic masterpiece, they were keen to tell the story of Jesus in a way that would appeal to South Indian viewers, raised on a steady diet of Indian mythologicals, social films, and tales laced with multiple fights, songs, and dance scenes. Tensions were heightened when Chandra hired Madhukuri Johnson to translate Coelho's screenplay from English into Telugu. And that's an important point to highlight. Not everyone in India speaks everyone else's languages. I'm sure that might seem obvious, but Coelho didn't know Telugu, so he wrote the entire screenplay in English, which made it easy for me as a researcher to be able to deal with original sources. So that was nice. And he actually sent me copies of his screenplays. I'm not sure if I'm the only person on the face of the earth who has copies of them today. He has since passed on, and so I count it a real privilege to have met him. Tensions were heightened. Like Chandra and Tirumalai, Johnson also had considerable experience in the Telugu film industry, but it was his religious and theological background that became a thorn in Coelho's side. Not only was he a Protestant, instead of simply translating Coelho's screenplay, he rewrote it, in Coelho's view, to suit his own theological and narrative agendas. Coelho had wanted to put Jesus' teachings in his own words and take creative license with the chronology of Jesus' story. Under Coelho's direction, for example, the Nativity of Christ would have appeared in the form of a flashback towards the middle of the film. His initial screenplay, he crafted two successively shorter versions, ended post-Jesus resurrection with two of Jesus' followers walking on the beach, reflecting on the significance of Jesus' life and teachings. By contrast, the final cut of Kadamaidu opens with the traditional harmonization of Jesus' early years, including his birth in a stable, visits from shepherds and magi, Herod's slaughter of the innocents, and a scene depicting him conversing at the age of 12 with temple leaders in Jerusalem. It ends, as already noted, with Jesus' ascension. To use Coelho's own words, if Johnson had been a Hindu, the story of Christ would have been completely new to him. He would have translated my ideas exactly as they were, but this man, being a Protestant and being familiar with his Bible, he put them all back in the biblical language. This may seem an odd complaint from a Catholic priest, but Coelho's disappointment expressed in those words only hints at the multiple negotiations of personality and power, aesthetics, and theological vision that marked Kadamaidu's journey to the silver screen. Not long after the film was released, he published an article that was a thinly veiled defense of why the film turned out the way it did. Despite his tensions with Johnson, the title of the essay is unequivocal in its attribution of responsibility for the film. how Hindus filmed the life of Christ. Given the strong influence of the Christian tradition on the film's production, however, it would be unfair to deduce from the title of Coelho's article that because Kadambalaya was produced by Hindus, that it was any less faithful to the biblical record than its major Western predecessors. Cecil B. DeMille's The King of Kings, Nicholas Ray's remake King of Kings, and as we discussed at the meal, Piero Pasolini's Gospel According to St. Matthew, although probably less so with Pasolini's, included extra-biblical plot lines and took creative license with the story as all films do. When Kadambalaya was released in December of 1978, this is a hoarding of the Hindu version of the film Dayasagar, which means Ocean of Mercy. However, the tensions that marked its production faded in light of its commercial success. Granted, Chanda reported that for the first few days, it appeared that the years of perseverance may have been in vain. Audiences were sparse. Within a couple of weeks, however, the film became a blockbuster by Indian cinema standards, reportedly running in one cinema in northern Andhra Pradesh for over 200 days. And if you've been to India and driven the streets, you'll remember that many of the film hoardings that are on the streets actually rate films by the number of days that they've been playing. So if it's been going for 75 days, it says 75 days emblazoned on the billboards, right? Better than a star rating on by a critic. This is one you want to see because it's been running a long time. So that kind of record is actually quite substantial. There are several explanations for its popularity. Because it was released in both Telugu and Malayalam, it was immediately accessible to the majority of South Indian viewers. Furthermore, it was released in South India, home to the largest concentration of Christians in India's population. Although DeMille's silent classic, The King of Kings, had been screened throughout India for decades prior, Christians had practiced a long-standing and principled prohibition against nudity attendance. Curiosity, however, in this case, trumped that prohibition, and I was told that for many Christians in India, seeing Kadambalaya was the first time they darkened the door of the theater. As the film's popularity indicated, however, Christians were not alone in their fascination with this subject. That a movie of Jesus' life would attract viewers to the cinema from a broad cross-section of India's population may come as a surprise to those unfamiliar with India's highly nuanced religious ethos, inflected as it is by myriad traditions. Yet as one Indian film critic remarked in reflection on Kadambalaya, given Jesus' popularity in India, it was a wonder that it took so long for a movie of his life to make its way onto Indian cinema screens. While the movie was showing to broad acclaim, its place in South Indian history, and its own history, I suppose, took an unexpected turn. John Gilman, a North American evangelical and former director of programming at Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network, was in India to oversee a media project for a local Christian ministry. When he saw a hoarding for Kadambalaya, Gilman arranged immediately to see the movie, but it was with some apprehension that he entered the theater. He was curious to see the film for a number of reasons related to his sense of vocation. During a spontaneous moment of prayer for direction nearly 10 years earlier, he reports having seen flickering on a white wall in front of him in the offices of CBN scenes from the life of Christ. That experience, among others, had reinforced in him a growing desire to, quote, visualize the gospel, unquote, and eventually culminated in his resignation from CBN because he realized that television just wasn't going to do it. Although a combination of several events had led him to consider India as the site to develop his vision, and the notion of a Christ movie was percolating at the time, he'd been apprehensive about going there. His presence in Andhra Pradesh at the time of Kadambalaya's release was therefore as much about trying to discern how to work out his vision for using film and evangelism as it was about the particular project with which he was involved. So he was conflicted. On the one hand, he was disillusioned because it appeared that someone had already accomplished what he had remortgaged his house to set out to achieve. On the other hand, he was stunned by local viewers' emotional and visceral responses to the film, especially when he heard some of them yelling, "They're killing an innocent man!" Unaware of the film's production history, he was also surprised by its relative faithfulness to the biblical record. At one point during the film, he claims to have recalled his vision from a decade earlier, and concluded with a start that this was the film he had seen flickering on that wall. His initial disillusionment was displaced by a renegotiated sense of calling. He was to distribute Cardinal Maidu instead of producing his own movie, and promptly he made plans to meet B.J. Chandler. The precise terms of their agreement, especially as they pertain to copyright, may never be fully known. Gilman has been a bit guarded about that with me. According to his account, however, he secured from Chandler the right to make an unlimited number of 16mm copies of the film to show free of charge throughout India. And within a year, Gilman oversaw the first screening of Cardinal Maidu in a village in Andhra Pradesh, where he had first seen the movie, in a theater, using a screen made of sheets sewn by a local tailor. It was the beginning of a film evangelism strategy that continues today, made possible largely by the volunteer efforts of young evangelical Indian Christians who travel throughout the country showing the movie 3 to 4 times a week wherever they could find an audience. Some of these people that I've talked to, I spent some time with one of these teams, have seen the movie reportedly up to 700 times. Talk about saturation. It's remarkable. The outcome of Gilman's initial efforts is noteworthy. Since 1979, the film has been dubbed into a total of 14 major Indian languages and shown to over 130 million viewers in over 250,000 villages. It's regularly screened on major television networks in South India during the Christmas and Easter seasons and has become the benchmark by which all subsequent efforts to film the life of Christ in India have been evaluated, and there have been more. Recently, Dayspring International, the organization that Gilman formed to support the exhibition of the film, had it digitally remastered, and they were kind enough to give me some copies on DVD and the old 16mm projectors that they used to haul up mountains and through rivers and all over the place were shelved in favor of digital projectors, which are much lighter and better sound systems. Currently, there are 275 film teams showing this movie throughout India on a weekly basis. Perhaps the only Jesus film with more notable distribution credentials is the Jesus film of Campus, now associated with Campus Crusade, which has reportedly been dubbed into over 1,000 languages and is exhibited by a vast and sophisticated network of Christian ministries and volunteers. So there you go. Brief overview of the history of Cardinal Maidu. This cursory overview of the film's journey to the silver screen highlights a tangle. I'm sure questions have begun to form already. Of religious, theological, cultural, and interpersonal negotiations that bring into sharp relief the question posed by the title of my presentation. Do you see what I see? Whereas the two filmmakers who initiated the project may have seen Jesus as a way to succeed in the film industry by exploiting the long-standing preference for devotional movies in South India, the investors at Amrit Dhabani recognized an opportunity to fulfill a papal mandate. Koyla envisioned a representation of Jesus that would raise the bar on local production values and invite viewers to consider Jesus' significance for their daily lives. Chandler wanted to represent Jesus in what I call the cinema franca. Gilman saw in the movie the opportunity to fulfill his spiritual vocation. Each of their agendas for the film was informed by a particular religious and theological milieu, but none of those influences were exclusive from the others. So to treat them individually is actually, in my view, doing the story and our understanding of the relationship between film, religion, theology, and injustice. We're not paying attention to the web of interrelations that mark any film's history, for that matter, but this one in particular. Therefore, not only does the content of Carter and I resist containment by a single theological tradition, so too its perceived function and effect. The religious, theological, and cultural nuances in this brief snapshot of the film's journey to the silver screen suggest that if we are to begin to grasp the scope of the film's religious and theological significance, it's imperative that we attend to the whole picture, its moving image. In the remaining paragraphs, I'll discuss briefly some select aspects of Carter Maidu's story, which complicates some of the influential biases that shape the literature on the film religion today. Now, how am I doing for time? Is that am I doing okay? So I'm shifting now to just thinking a little bit about kind of reflecting on the story that we just heard. Okay? In their helpful introduction to Indian cinema, Moti Gokul Singh and Vimal Desai Nayake, hope I got that right, argue that one of the benefits of studying Indian films, especially for Western observers, is the opportunity to see their own culture through new eyes. We were discussing this a little bit at the dinner table, that people used to ask me, is this a good film? And I would say, by whose standards? Right? Similarly, I suggest attending to the negotiations of film, religion, and theology that have marked Karnamayu's journey can complicate and enrich our appreciation for those discussions and how we play out those relationships in our own lives. The complexities are obvious, and I've listed them. One of the most noticeable contributions that the story of Karnamayu has to offer is its displacement of Eurocentrism. Discussions of Jesus and film in particular in the literature discussions of Jesus and film have focused primarily on well-known Western movies of Jesus. You can probably think of a few that you've seen over the years that get shown again and again. You'll probably see some at Christmas. And their relationship to North American and European cultures, artistic traditions. Your own Dr. Goa did a fabulous piece on Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ, that was helpful for my work, and the ever-modulating perceptions of Jesus in those environments, whether critical or pious. But keep this in mind. Carter Maidu preceded by nearly a year the release of Jesus, which became Campus Crusade's Jesus film, Life of Brian. Okay. It preceded the release of The Last Temptation of Christ and Jesus of Montreal by nearly a decade, and Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ by nearly 30 years. So it kind of puts it in perspective a little bit. And despite its impressive distribution statistics, it is yet to be relatively unknown to Western scholars. Thanks in part to the fanfare surrounding Gibson's Passion of Christ and the attendant revival of scholarly and journalistic interest in cinematic representation of Jesus, we have room to thank for that, the film is slowly becoming known beyond Indian borders. But it's worth noting that Eurocentrism is not the only bias that it unsettles. By focusing on a South Indian film, this essay deliberately resists what I call the Bollywood centrism in scholarship concerning Indian cinema. So if people talk about Indian cinema, they assume you're talking about Bollywood. So I always get very complicated answers when people ask me, oh, is it a Bollywood film? No. I thought you said it was an Indian film. Yes. It's not Bollywood, no. Right. Actually, about 60% of India's cinema screens are in the south. And it's probably a larger producer overall of movies than the north. But because of Hindi being so universal, Hindi films from Bombay, from Bollywood, actually traffic throughout India and around the world. And so India is known for Bollywood, when actually there's this very, very rich tradition in the part of the country. The nuances of Carter Maidu's story also complicate a long-standing tendency among Western scholars to frame film's relationship to to religion and theology, this is important to understand, in terms of Christianity's relationship, to an increasingly secularized Western culture. Okay, so the whole discussion, at least early on, was framed by this tension. Their efforts to build bridges between the church and Western culture were shaped by an environment in which the place of religion in the public sphere was downplayed, and traditional theological discourse was rendered virtually meaningless. Critics who were attentive to such trends, therefore, had little time for films that were explicitly religious in content or theme. James Wall, whose film reviews will probably be familiar to longtime readers of Christian Century, argued that biblical spectaculars would lose their appeal, he argued this in 1970, due to a decline in biblical knowledge and religious presuppositions. In the face of such conditions, Neil Hurley took a page from literary critics who were attempting to draw dotted lines between Christianity and themes in modern literature. So one of his initial forays into film criticism was an essay on the cinematic Jesus in film, that drew on the work of literary critics like Robert Detweiler and Fyodor Zhilkovsky, both of whom had published similar treatises for analyses of American literature. Protestant theologian Paul Tillich's thesis about the relationship between culture, theology, and religion was also influential in these efforts. In every cultural creation, he argued, whether a picture, a system, a law, a political movement, however secular it may be, an ultimate concern is expressed, and it is possible to recognize the unconscious theological character of it. One can hear Tillich's thesis echoing in Hurley's oft-quoted assertion that, quote, films are to the masses what theology is to the elite. So that was kind of the framework in which, an environment in which much of the literature on film and religion began to percolate. As pertinent as such assumptions may be for the Western context, however, the intersection and negotiation of religious traditions and history of code and bindings production and reception do not fit tightly into such a one-to-one relationship. Given the diverse objects of worship, spiritual authorities, and practices that populate daily life in India, one might justifiably ask how Hurley's question would play out in that context, or his assertion, whose theology, which elite, what films, which masses. Furthermore, secularization in India is generally cast in a different mold than in the West. Instead of an environment where religion is deemed separate from public life, secularization in India has been conceived as a context in which all religious communities live together in peace. Very different dynamic, but a very important one to understand and appreciate. This dynamic is especially true in the film industry. Again, we're discussing this at dinner. Indian film critic K.A. Abbas once commented that after watching actors play characters from religious backgrounds other than their own, and this is very common in the industry actually, he was, and I quote, prepared to believe in an idyllic India in which Hindus and Muslims, Brahmins and Hardikins can and do live together in an atmosphere of amity and goodwill. You forget the riots and concentrate on the goodness and the compassion of the screen characters. Granted, tensions between religious communities prevail and extremists wreak havoc still. Nevertheless, one need only walk the streets of an Indian city past blackened shrines tucked between high rises to affirm that the bifocal quality of a Western conception of secularization is inadequate to describe the relationship between religion and daily life in the nation. Likewise, we're soon getting to the good stuff. Efforts to find the unconscious theological character, to use Tillich's phrase, of Western films have often been linked to another set of assumptions that are not easily mapped over the Indian context, namely that film is art and that certain kinds of art are more theologically significant than others. Paul Schrader developed this thesis for the cinematic medium in his thin volume called Transcendental Style in Film, where he advocated a, quote, spare approach to filmmaking that would facilitate encounters with the holy, especially through what he called cinematic stasis. To achieve such encounters, in other words, if you're going to meet God, if you're going to enable people to have religious and holy encounters in the context of film, you need to create an environment for them to do that. And there are certain aesthetic principles that are more suitable for that than others. That was his thesis, right? In his view, to achieve such encounters, he argued, one must avoid employing elements that are primarily expressive of human experience, or that attempt to evoke the appropriate emotions. In other words, don't have so many people crying because you want your viewers to cry. Right? You should set it up so that viewers actually just start crying. So that's kind of an oversimplification of his thesis. In his view, producers of biblical epics were guilty of such errors and were mistaken in their attempts to make the spiritual real by putting spiritual content on film. Indian cinema, however, generally resists Schrader's criteria, both stylistically and especially in its treatment of divine figures. The portrayal of Jesus via crucis in Karnamaidu is a case in point, and if I can get it to play, I'm going to show a snippet in a moment. Not only does the camera cut repeatedly to the crying faces of Jesus' disciples and his mother Mary, the lyrics sung by the narrator during this episode, and it's quite a lengthy one, I'm only going to show you about a minute or two, are deliberately designed to provoke sympathy for the injustices being suffered by Jesus. Okay? Just give me a moment. Perception of the religious value of films. These influences, in turn, have implications for understanding the portrayal of Jesus, the portrayal of Jesus in Kadamandi, and its reception. And I'm just going to develop that really quickly here. Indian cinema scholar Ashish Vajradyaksha has argued convincingly that although the inspiration for an Indian film industry, get this, can be traced to the screening of a French Jesus movie, La Vie de Jésus-Christ, the industry itself has been shaped from its beginning by what one might refer to loosely as a Hindu imagination and aesthetic. D.G. Palki, the reputed father of Indian cinema, was inspired, after watching the movie Jesus, by the possibility of replacing Jesus on the screen with images of what he referred to as India's gods to produce the first mythological film, a genre that's quite unique to India. One of his challenges involved adapting for the cinematic medium the possibility of divine encounters. Do you have Schrader in the background here? The possibility of divine encounters with the gods that had previously been limited to three-dimensional deities or two-dimensional god posters. The desire to facilitate such encounters was closely tied to the Hindu principle of darshan, namely the belief that one enters the presence of a deity's image not only to see, but to be seen by, or to be in the presence of the deity that it represents. Okay, you got that? Vajradyaksha has argued that Palki accomplished this transfer from two-dimensional posters and three-dimensional statues and so on to film by having the actors who played these deities face the camera directly, so straight on, very frontal shots, and then filming them in long, almost static takes. Although mythological films have long since lost their pride of place in the genres, range of genres available to Indian viewers, the integral relationship between the concept of darshan and screen-based portrayals of divine beings has endured. In the late 1980s, a television series based on the epic Mahabharata, I'm supposed to be back here now. I need to follow my own notes. Swept India by storm and prompted viewers from all walks of life to adorn their television sets with flowers, effectively turning them into shrines. This despite the production values that were the antithesis of Paul Schrader's criteria for a transcendent style of filmmaking. Indian pastors tell me that they had a hard time going to church on Sunday morning for two reasons. They weren't sure their congregation was going to be there, because that's when it was shutting. Think about this. This is like 2 years that it showed. Plus, they wanted to watch. And so they would often tape it so they could watch the series when they got home from church. Okay? I mean, this series just permeated the culture. All right? So, anecdotal accounts that surfaced during my research confirmed that given their openness to the possibility of Jesus' divinity, some Hindu viewers treated the screen of Kadamandi as an opportunity for darshan of Jesus. In other words, they might come to watch the film out of a desire to participate in the blessings of Christ's presence, rather than out of a historical interest in the details of Jesus' story, or out of a desire to reflect on the redemptive aspect of his life, death, and resurrection. The possibility of having darshan with Jesus in Kadamandi is suggested through the use of close-ups of Jesus' eyes in the film, and I'm going to show you this. Using the technique shot-reverse-shot, these sequences are cut into a number of Jesus' key encounters with characters in the film that give them a kind of efficacious quality, because after every one of these encounters, the shot-reverse-shot with close-ups of Jesus' eyes, that person who's involved in that encounter is changed in some way. Okay? So I'm just going to have to pop out a DVD here, and then I'm going to pop this in for you.
The goblin's the
Alright. I'll explain what happens here in a moment, but I'm just going to let it play. Sorry. I'll play that again.
Guru Varya, main jhoda nahi aapne.
Jhoda
chhe. Jhoda to aam kya kar?
Tum sabha nahi jhoda kar chhe. Aam tum sabha nahi jhoda kar chhe.
Guru Varya.
Play that again while I'm out of the way.
Guru Varya, main jhoda nahi aapne.
Jhoda chhe.
Jhoda to aam kya kar?
Tum sabha nahi jhoda kar chhe. Ami hum sabha nahi jhoda kar chhe.
Guru Varya.
Maru anusarin kar.
It helps that there's a bell to signal here. So a number of these sequences actually occur in the film. At one point, Judas Iscariot has a similar encounter with Jesus as he's trying to decide if he wants to become a disciple of Jesus. There's another one where there's a healing that takes place. And I always forget the fourth of any list that I try to recount, so apologies. But this happens about four times in the film. And it's not that other films haven't done that, even in Western cinema. We're talking about Pasolini's film. Pasolini uses that technique as well, but it obviously functions very deliberately within the narrative in this particular account. Now, what does that mean for viewers? I had the privilege of working, attending or being part of a number of public screenings of this movie as it's being used for evangelism by one of the groups in India. And it just so happened, while I was at one of these screenings, that they were actually filming for publicity purposes the whole event. And they gave me the footage afterwards. And I heard about something that happened during that event that I never got to see. I was really excited about it. And then I discovered a video footage. So I'm going to show that to you now. Okay. So up on the screen, you can see, it's going to be hard to see because of the light in here. But up on the screen, the film is actually showing. Okay. You'll see a flash of light down here. And I'll explain what's happening later if you can't actually see it. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I can make this. Oh, I can make it bigger. Basically, what happened there was a lady voluntarily, got up, walked to the front, and while the film was shown, lit a candle at each of the posts holding up the screen. and then walked away. Right? I mean, to me, this just points to the complexity of what it means to understand what is going on when we watch Indian cinema of any kind, right? But specifically, in this case, what's going on in the context of this person's engagement with Jesus on film, in a public setting. That particular screening was remarkable because it was out in a public square. There was traffic. During that time, a tractor pulled up and unloaded a ton of bricks. People were wandering in. It did not fit nearly entirely into the categories that most people would write about in reception studies today. Okay. But what's significant is what that person was responding to in a cinematic context. Okay. One of the most profound examples of how religious and theological frameworks can shape our encounters in film involves a conversation I had with an Indian woman who has seen Karunamayi many times in evangelistic contexts. She asked me what I thought of the film, and I mentioned that I was intrigued by the influence of Hindu mythology in the movie. Stunned, she retorted that she had seen the movie many, many times, and that there were no allusions to Hindu mythology in the movie whatsoever. As my research indicates, however, and I'm about to show you, she had very selective vision. The influences of Indian mythology in Karunamayi can be observed even more clearly at the close of the film when Jesus addresses his disciples for the final time and then ascends into a galaxy of stars. And this is the clue that I give at the end of my talk. John Weingartz, who played a key role in improving Roman Catholic investment in the project, has acknowledged that the portrayal of Jesus' ascension and how it was portrayed, and you'll see it in a minute, was a deliberate allusion to a mythological account of Krishna's return to the abode of the gods, to Devlok, after appearing on earth in heaven, in human form, to restore righteousness in a world overcome by evil. According to Weingartz, the inclusion of this allusion in the film reflected a theological discussion that was contemporary to that period about the possibility that Hindu traditions could function as the Old Testament had for Christians, as a pointer to the revelation of Jesus Christ as the Son of God and Savior of the world. Weingartz recognized that Christianity, and I think this is important, he recognized that Christianity and the biblical canon were not the cornerstones of Indian culture. Right? And indeed, Christianity in Indian films is more often associated with the seedy characters of the courtesan and alcoholic than with the hero of the film. Someday I'll have this all coordinated, and then I'll just be able to click a button and it'll go. So I think this is
thank you.
Did you notice anything about that scene? Was there something, did anything strike you about that? I feel like I'm in class now. You're not going to get graded on this answer. I'm just curious. He didn't go up. He just got bigger. Right? Bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Which is, again, an illusion, and I don't have a precise source, but this often happens in the stories of the gods, where they kind of return to their normal size or relationship to the universe, as it were. In fact, there's one account of, I forget the story, but about one of the gods comes down as a dwarf, and he makes a deal with one of the kings that he can have however much land he can, you know, cover in 3 steps. And then he goes to his full size, of course, and paces up the universe, right? So this is not uncommon in Indian mythology. So not only have Indian filmmakers, I want to just note in closing that not only have Indian filmmakers drawn heavily on the epics Ramayana and Mahabharata for themes and source material, in much the same way that we look for Christ figures in film, but from the outset of the industry, they've also had to negotiate the implications of creating films for viewers in a pluralistic religious environment, not to mention a complicated political one. And just to mention that in passing, because it opens a whole other can of worms, but thus Kadamani complicates any attempt to universally apply the practice of drawing correlations between biblical themes and Western cultural products. So, final words. It would be disingenuous to suggest that the network of Eurocentric biases just addressed are still predominant in the critical discourse about film, religion, and theology, although they are there. Since the late 1980s and 90s, contributors to literature have represented a variety of disciplines, including but not limited to ideological, mythological, feminist, and psychoanalytical criticism, as well as religious and cultural studies. And I just thought it might be helpful for you to kind of just even see some of the books that have been put out. There are newer ones. This is an old collection already. But dealing specifically with theology, those are some of the bread plates. Representing Religion in World Cinema, Rachel Dwyer's Filming the Gods, and Brent Plate and Jolyon Mitchell's, Jolyon was my supervisor, The Religion and Film Reader, are but 3 important examples of texts produced in the last decade that reflect this shift in focus. Although tonight's limited glimpses into the content and history of Kadamani offer a modest contribution to such trajectories, however, I do not mean to discount them as irrelevant. I've only sought to complicate them. It has been my objective to suggest that a more nuanced and enriched understanding of film's relationship to religion and theology awaits us if we are willing to learn how to see as others see. Thank you.
Thank you. Right.